Today we're looking at Daniel chapter 1, verses 1 through 21, the entire chapter. In this series of sermons, Your Kingdom Come. Now we find first of all in chapter 1, the wisdom that overcomes the world. But let's review very briefly. In the beginning, where we started last week, in the beginning, the great king made the heavens and earth. Right? He created a kingdom where his glory could be displayed in a temple where he would rule. He created mankind as his image to rule the earth under him. Then there was rebellion in the kingdom. And so that a world system came into being in opposition to the glory of God. But the Lord graciously covenanted with man to bring his kingdom of life and blessing to the whole world. He covenanted with Abraham, he called him from Ur, entered into covenant with him to bless him and all the earth through him. In faithfulness to that covenant, God delivered the children of Israel from Egypt and entered into covenant with them at Mount Sinai so that they would be a kingdom of priests to him to mediate his glory and his saving rule to the whole earth. But Israel was not faithful to the covenant with the Lord. He called for loyal love. She was not a faithful bride. She committed adultery with the idols. So, the Lord faithfully executed the judgment provisions of the very covenant, the curses of the covenant, and sent her into exile at the hands of her enemies. So that, of course, raises the question, what's going to become of God's kingdom plan? Is God's purpose going to be frustrated? Will he rule in righteousness? Did God just cede the world to Satan and say, I'm through with it. You take it for a while. That wasn't what's going on. Will God glorify himself in saving his people? This is where the book of Daniel comes in. And we saw last week the theological setting of the book of Daniel in verses 1 and 2. And now we're going to step back a little bit and view chapter 1 as the prologue to the entire book of Daniel. We're asking ourselves, what now sets the stage for the unveiling of the kingdom of God that's going to take place in the book of Daniel? What glimmers do we have of God's glory being revealed, even in these dark days of judgment in which this book opens up? Where we find that, interestingly enough, is in God's dealings, gracious dealings, with four young Judean captives. Four young men, maybe middle teenage years. How God deals with them is like a little microcosm of what he's going to do in his great kingdom plan. The drama is played out, of course, with these human actors, but behind it all is the Lord. And so in this chapter, we're going to see God exercise his dominion in and through four young Israelites. Now, as I said, Daniel 1 is the prologue to the book here, which demonstrates the Lord's kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion endures from generation to generation. And yet, in this grand sweep of human history, the amazing thing is, and the beautiful thing, I think, in this book, is how God begins this book not with some of the majestic scenes that we're going to see later on, these amazing angelic creatures and things that are going to be happening, but he actually starts it on a very personal level in his dealings with these young men and how he shows his faithfulness. Again, in Daniel's life, we have a little microcosm of the work of the great king to show his loving rule on the earth. Right away from this, you can see that God's loving lordship, his dominion over the nations, his dominion over the universe, is still something very personal. It's something that touches your life. Though he is the Lord of space and time and history and all things in them, it is true what the Bible says, that his eye is on the sparrow and that he knows the hairs of your head. This is not something insignificant in this great sweep of history that God is accomplishing. Your life finds its meaning in God's kingdom plan. The decisions that you make, the actions that you take, they all find their significance in God showing his dominion on the earth. In fact, as we enter into this today, with this prayer that God would show his kingdom, that his kingdom would come, I want you to remember that you can be like the kind of person Daniel chapter 12 describes at the end of this book in verse 3. Those who are wise shall shine, he's talking about in the resurrection, like the brightness of the sky above, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. You can be wise and lead others to righteousness. And so I think what we see, to try to put this in a nutshell, coming into Daniel chapter 1, is that God exercises his saving rule, his dominion, by giving his people the wisdom to overcome the world. God exercises his saving rule by giving his people the wisdom to overcome the world. And I think here's how the text shows this. Here's just why I want to break it up here this morning for our understanding. And I want to basically do it along the lines of three times in this chapter that the Lord specifically is said to act, and to act in a certain way, and that is giving. Three times in this chapter, at turning points in the chapter, it says that God gave. The Lord gave, God gave, and God gave. He's the actor behind all that's going on here. And we need to understand the outworking of this chapter in that way. And by the way, let me pause for a second and insert something else here. That is crucial to recognize. That though we could read this chapter first and foremost as a story about Daniel, it is really the story of Daniel in the light of the story of God and what he's accomplishing. Make sure we see that. So we, first of all, in verses 1 through 7, we're going to see that God gives his people judgment. He gives covenant curses to his people. And that leads to the pressure of worldly power and wisdom being applied to them. But, secondly, God gives his people favor and compassion in the sight of his enemies in verses 8 through 16. Here we see God's power proved in the face of the world's power. But it doesn't stop with that. It goes on in verses 17 to 21 to give, God gives wisdom to surpass and even outlast his enemies. We see the triumph, the preeminence of God's wisdom over all this world's wisdom. But of course it starts out in verses 1 through 7 with the pressure of worldly power and wisdom. We read verses 1 and 2 last week. Let me pick up verse 3. Then, this is after Daniel, his friends, after Nebuchadnezzar had captured Jerusalem, taken away captives, plundered the temple, brought those to his god in the land of Shinar. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. So we find here that the cream of the Judean youth was taken away to Babylon to become an ingredient in the Babylonian recipe for a great kingdom. Okay, we're going to take the best of what they've got. We're going to mix them right into our kingdom so that our kingdom will be great. They were to, in a sense, lose their distinctiveness as the people of God and become Babylonian so that all their gifts, all their talents, all their abilities could make Babylon great. Here is the world system applying all of its ingenuity to produce conformity. You're familiar with Romans chapter 12, where it tells us not to be conformed to this world, right? Well, here Daniel and these three friends are put in a situation because of God's judgment where all the pressure that the world has to bring to bear is put on them. All the world's power, all the world's wisdom. Pardon me. Now consider the situation of these young men. They were in this situation because of God's just judgment. They weren't like Job, who could cry out, "Why do the righteous suffer? I mean, what's going on here? I don't understand this." I think these young men probably knew exactly why they were in this captivity. It's entirely possible, in fact, that they had heard Jeremiah himself preaching in the streets of Jerusalem. That's where they were from. They knew what was going on. God had been sending his prophets, telling his people, this is what's going to happen to you. And now it had happened. Now they were taken away and put into exile. Exile from God's land. Exile from God's temple. Exile from the people of God. And so because of the sin of their own people, and even, we might suppose, the sin of their own family members. I mean, these were of the nobility. These were not just the nobodies out there. These were the important power brokers in Judea of their day. And they were the ones who were not following God. I bet Daniel and his three friends probably had relatives that this applied to. They knew why they were in captivity. Because of the sin of their own people, they were now in exile in the court in Babylon. And because of that judgment, they were now in this place of tremendous pressure to conform in the face of worldly power and wisdom. I say worldly power because the Babylonians at this time had all the military and political power on their side. I mean, they were the ones who were winning now, right? They were the ascendant kingdom in the world. They had just crushed the remnants of the Assyrian Empire and Egypt, their ally. They had asserted their dominance over all this region of the world. They said, we're the up-and-coming power here. Pardon me. Politically, militarily, they had the power. Who had just conquered who, by the way? I mean, Daniel and his three friends were part of the group that had just been conquered. You weren't the ones in power anymore. But not only that, Daniel and his friends were now in a place where they were even provided for by the Babylonian system. You see, in verse 5, the king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. Where did they even get their daily bread, so to speak? From their Babylonian captors? From their overlords? They were entirely dependent. They were in a place of entire weakness here. The Babylonians had all the power. They had the power of provision. We might even say the power of the purse. Or as sometimes I like to say it, the one who pays the bills calls the shots. I mean, the Babylonians said, hey, we say what's going on here because we're providing for you. We're the ones taking care of things. And whenever you have this kind of a situation, you have a tremendous temptation to conform, to go along, to get along. Because after all, everything in the whole system seems to work that way, right? They've got the power. We don't have any. How could we even possibly resist anything? That's the way it's always been in human history. With nations, governments, human governments, exerting their authority, their power, to accomplish their agenda and their objectives. I thought of this interesting illustration even from our early American history. The same phenomenon in human history. One of the reasons our American founders set up governments the way they did is because they knew this fact about human governments. And early in the colonial era, and then as the United States became a nation, and the various states set up their own rules for voting, the vast majority of them would only allow freeholders to vote. Now, from many people's perspective today, that's an infringement on people's freedom. Why would you only limit the vote to certain people who were landowners? Was it simply an arbitrary restriction? Part of the rationale for it in the minds of many of the founders was that freeholders have something to depend on and to defend against the interests of the government. They're not easily swayed by the promises of politicians that will provide for you. Hey, you elect me, I'll give you this. You elect me, I'll give you that. I don't need you to give me things. I have my provision right here, and I'll take care of this. Thank you very much. That was a little bit of the attitude. And therefore, they wouldn't be tempted to vote for somebody who could put them on the dole, promise them all kinds of things. Is that something unique to that time? It's still with us to this day. This is the tendency, the temptation, the very human temptation of human governments. Babylon was no different, right? They say, hey, we'll provide for you. You come here, we'll take you here, we will provide for you. And not only that, but in the case of these young men, we'll give you the very best. You get to eat from what the king eats. You get the food from his table. You get the wine that he drinks. You have the best of everything if you come be a part of our system, right? Work for us. We promise you the best. Yes, you're a slave in a sense, but you have it way better than you'd have it anywhere else in the whole wide world. So come work for us. That's what you have going on here. Pardon me. Whenever you have the collusion of political or legal power, military power, and economic power, you have an incredible incentive to conform. The Babylonians knew that, as one man has put it, more flies are caught by honey than by vinegar. You have it good. Hey, these captives were in a sense being wined and dined, literally. Come here. We've got the best. We'll give it to you. You have the good life if you'll only serve Babylon. So that was the issue of worldly power. But there was also the issue of worldly wisdom that Daniel and his friends had to confront. In verse 4 and 5, it tells us that as they took these young men, they selected ones who had great, we might call it intellectual abilities. But they wanted to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. So they set them into a program, a 3-year program, by which they would re-educate them, train them, so that they would be fit to stand before the king, to minister and serve the king of Babylon himself. There was a very aggressive and thorough re-education program going on. And of course, in a sense, this too was a great opportunity from a worldly perspective for intelligent young men. I mean, where would an intelligent, aspiring young man want to go if he wanted to study at the top university in the world, so to speak, in his day? Go to Babylon. They've got it, right? They've got all the best thinkers, the most knowledgeable scientists, the cosmopolitan philosophers, the cutting-edge research, and you're going to be trained in all this knowledge. In fact, we still have some of that knowledge available to us today in the Sanskrit writing, the cuneiform tablets that we have today. Daniel and his friends would have learned how to write that and read that, and thus have access to all the records of the Babylonian, say the Babylonian astrologers who studied the movements of the stars and the planets. And I mean, they would know things about the planets that would be kind of comparable to the cutting-edge physicists of our day and astronomers. Hey, this is stuff that only the most educated people know. And you really can have an advancement. You can advance your career if you come and study here, so to speak, right? This is the place to come. Come and get it here. This is what this pressure was designed to do, ultimately, to give them an entirely new identity, which I think is indicated in verse 7 by their new names. They were no longer Jewish young men, according to the Babylonians, whose very names indicated their relationship to God, the God of Israel. For instance, Daniel's name means God is my judge. But now, they were given new names. Babylon didn't want just a melting pot where everybody kind of kept their own identity. They wanted to bring them there to assimilate them, to make them part of us. That's what we're here for, right? That's our agenda for our kingdom. Now, it's not, of course, as if these different names were inherently sinful. These young men did use them, even for the rest of their lives. But it does indicate, I think, how thoroughly Babylon wanted to immerse them in their own culture. We want to make these young men, in effect, Babylonians. We're not having Jews here in the court of Babylon. We're having men who used to be Jews, who are now Babylonians, serving in the court. There was a tremendous pressure to conform here of worldly power and wisdom. And by the way, folks, this is still the way the world works today. The world system exerts its power and its wisdom as if it were inevitable reality. Right? Have you ever heard the phrase, people saying things like, you're on the wrong side of history? I mean, this is the way things are going. You better get on board or you're just left out. This is the way the world works. This is the way the system works. In other words, if nothing else, you need to go along to get along. So the world's going to use its economic tools. It's going to use its educational tools. It's going to use its legal tools to put pressure on God's people to conform. Let me just give you a quick illustration of of a concern of that, even in our nation right now, just at the last Supreme Court session, as they were hearing, I'm going to forget the name of the case as I say it to you here today, dealing with same-sex marriage arguments. And the justices questioned the administration's representative there as to whether that would affect tax-exempt status of Christian institutions like colleges, universities, and other things of that nature. The administration, or the representative of the administration, replied, "Well, that will definitely be an issue." He didn't say what the issue exactly would be, but it would be an issue. And so just recently, in fact, I think it was last week, I heard about a coalition of about 75 different heads of Christian institutions, colleges, and universities, mainly across the United States, sending, petitioning, basically, to Congress to pass legislation that would make it clear that we're not to be taxed just because we don't conform to what seems to be coming down the pike in our country. Okay, we don't know what will happen or how that will turn out in our particular nation at this time. But it's not at all a stretch, or wouldn't be something surprising or unusual to us as Christians, should it be, to say, to see a human government say, no, we're going to use the economic levers we have to say, you have to conform. Even if we don't overtly persecute, we start applying pressure. We start using levers. You know, hit people in the pocketbook, right? Then they'll start to conform a little bit, because we believe this is the agenda we have. That could very well happen in our nation. We don't know. But this is the kind of thing that the world system does. Now, given that pressure of the world's power and wisdom, what do we see Daniel doing in verses 8 through 16? I think to put it in a nutshell, we could say we see Daniel proving God's power, first of all. Proving God's power. It says in verse 8, "But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself." So what did Daniel do here? Remember, he's a captive. It's not, he doesn't have a vote in this matter, right? It's not like he can start a political campaign or something. He doesn't have a whole lot of choice in what's happening to him. And I think his response in that scenario is truly insightful. He didn't say, "I won't accept your education. Sorry, you can't teach me." He didn't say, "I will hatch a plot to assassinate this wicked king who is attacking God's people. He's ungodly. We just need to get rid of him." He didn't do that either. Why? I think Daniel knew in his wisdom that God had put him in that position, right? He was there justly. This was God's judgment, in a sense, that he was having to deal with, and yet he was going to be faithful to God. He realized that God was the one who had put him in that position. And of course, that was just the point. It was his relationship to God that was the key issue. And that's what comes out in verse 8. He resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food. When you hear that word defilement, what you should understand, your mind should immediately go back to the book of Leviticus and what God taught his people, Daniel being one of them, about how they would live with a holy God. Leviticus is where Daniel would have learned about what defilement meant, even. It wasn't just things like, oh, he got dirty. It had to do with his relationship to God. In the covenant that God made through Moses, he gave laws that dealt with cleanness and uncleanness, or purity and defilement. Now today, people, maybe you've been in this boat, we read those laws in Leviticus and don't really know what to do with them. Okay, God said that to them for some reason, so they had to do it for whatever reason, and I'm glad I don't have to figure that out. And that's about the extent of what we learn from the laws in Leviticus, right? God, and so we actually perceive them as basically arbitrary. God said it, so we do it. I have no idea why. Well, that's fine. Just like in our own lives as children growing up, that's fine if you're 2 years old. You know, there's a point in a young person's life where they just, you do it because mom and dad say to do it. And you have to learn by doing it, right? But if you have a 20-year-old that still can't understand why in the world mom and dad said to do certain things and not do other things, then that's not a good sign of maturity, right? He hasn't really learned what those very instructions were actually intended to accomplish. We need to make sure we don't do the same kind of things. Even looking back at those old covenant purity laws, I think Daniel actually had internalized them well and understood them well. And so because he had the wisdom to deal with this situation. Because we haven't, we don't really understand the wisdom behind Daniel's decision, his resolve in this text. You see, the cleanness laws in Leviticus were all about the fact that a holy God was dwelling in the midst of his people. And these cleanness laws were then to shape Israel's character to match the character of her God. By that very practice, by that very repetition of these truths, they had to learn what it meant to live with a holy God. These were an intricate application, actually, of Israel, to Israel's life, of the creation order, of covenant guidelines, and then the consummation of all things in God. By means of these laws, holiness was connected with life and fullness of life and good life, while impurity was connected with death and decay and destruction. And so by practicing these purity laws, Israel was set apart to the Lord as his distinct people. That's what God was accomplishing by giving those laws to them. And I think Daniel understood well the direction of these laws, the kind of character that they were intended to shape, the life with God that they were intended to produce. Because he was then able, in a totally new situation, to apply truth from that, even though there was no explicit law that dealt with his situation. There was no black and white, do this, don't do that. In fact, that comes out when we start to examine his decision, his resolve. Some people have thought, when you think of what Daniel did, he resolved not to defile himself with the king's food or the wine that he drank, that it had to do with what we would nowadays call kosher laws. Things like you have to drain the blood properly from the meat before you cook it. Or perhaps those Babylonians ate lots of kinds of meat that were forbidden to the Jews, like horse meat and pig meat. Babylonians didn't have any problem eating those things. Jews couldn't, according to their law. So was Daniel just saying, I'm not going to eat those foods because they're unclean in that sense? Probably not that, pardon me, because he also resolved that he would not drink the wine that the king drank. And there is no law, no cleanness law, that forbids drinking wine. Israelites were perfectly allowed to do that. The only ones who were not were the Nazarites who had taken that vow. So that doesn't seem to explain why Daniel made this decision. And so some have thought, well, perhaps it was because this food was offered in sacrifice to idols. The Babylonians worshipped false gods. They did sacrifice food to idols. And therefore, Daniel wouldn't wanted to participate in that idolatry in any way. Again, perhaps that influenced him. However, given the fact that he said he wanted to eat vegetables, those two would have been offered to the king in sacrifice, or to the idols, to the false gods, in sacrifice. So he still hadn't really escaped that problem by saying, just give us food and water, vegetables and water. So why was it? Well, I think the key issue for Daniel, that Daniel really perceived was at stake here, was this: who gives me life? Who gives me life and health and strength? Upon whom does my life depend? The king of Babylon or the king of heaven? You see, the king of Babylon gave them a diet of rich food, which was designed to make them strong. In fact, that's exactly the issue that the steward brought up to Daniel when he asked about this. Look at verse 10. Actually, I should back up to verse 9 because I haven't mentioned it yet. And God gave Daniel favor. Here's God giving favor. Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear, my lord, the king who assigned your food and your drink. Why should he see that you are in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king, right? It's all about you becoming the kind of person the king wants you to be. He's given you this food on purpose, because by it you'll become strong. You'll become the best all you can be. This is the best food of everybody, of everywhere. And you're going to reject that, and you just want vegetables and water? You're not going to be as healthy as these other people. That's what he was concerned about. I think that was the issue at stake. You see, what the king was doing, in a sense, was by providing for them this rich food by which they would live and become all they were meant to be, he would sublimate them into his kingdom rule. They would depend upon him to realize their potential. They would depend upon him for their daily bread. But Daniel, I think, challenged this at its root. He chose food, which was a mere subsistence diet. Give us vegetables and water. He chose food which would showcase the power of God in giving health and strength. You see, his relationship with God was the fundamental relationship of his life. And he was not going to violate that for anything. He wanted to be purely the Lord's. He was dedicated to God because he depended upon God. I think Daniel would have understood perfectly what Jesus taught us when he taught us to pray, "Give us this day our daily bread." That was not just a request for subsistence, for sustenance. It's a declaration of dependence. It's, "You are my God, you are my King, you provide everything for me. I depend upon you." That was exactly the issue that was at stake here, and that's what Daniel was driving at in this request. You see, folks, this is a powerful preventative against idolatry. The world system always works in your life in such a way as to say, you need this. You have to have this in order to live, right? How can you have a good life if you don't have what our world system provides for you? The desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, the pride of life, the pride in the stuff of life. The world is always working to fertilize and to draw out these desires. But when Daniel demonstrated this kind of dependence and consecration, we see again who was really directing the course of events. The Lord gave. God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And in the end, God's power was demonstrated to be enough. He went through the test, and in verse 15 it says, at the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. God's power was enough. Daniel had demonstrated here that he did not need King Nebuchadnezzar's rich food in order to become what he was supposed to be. He did not depend upon that. He did not depend upon Nebuchadnezzar for life. God's power quietly but thoroughly triumphed over worldly power. Of course, it didn't stop there. And I think we see in verse 17, God giving again. As for these four youths, God gave. God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Here we find the preeminence of God's wisdom over worldly wisdom. Because what happened? At the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king spoke with them. And among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they stood before the king. And in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. 10 times better. That's the preeminence of God's wisdom. Note the irony here, by the way. Don't miss the irony in this story. Nebuchadnezzar took these promising, intelligent, physical specimens, if you will, from Judah to say, "Hey, come over here and we're going to train you. We're going to give you all of our instruction and wisdom so that you'll be equipped to serve the king." But they ended up surpassing all the Babylonian wisdom. And so the king consulted them for instruction. They were 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in the kingdom. Do you see how God's wisdom quietly triumphed over the worldly wisdom? Hey, we're going to teach you how it's done. And now God sends them there, and they teach the Babylonians how it's done. In fact, that's exactly what you're going to see throughout the book of Daniel. You're going to see worldly rulers having to come to recognize the Lord reigns. The Lord reigns. We thought we were powerful. We thought we were in charge. We thought we knew everything. But the Lord reigns. Daniel showed that by his life. Pardon me. I think this story in Daniel chapter 1 is a perfect illustration of Proverbs 2, 6, and 7. For the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth come knowledge and understanding. He stores up sound wisdom for the upright. He is a shield to those who walk in integrity. Daniel walked in integrity. And so the Lord was his shield. And the Lord gave him wisdom, which overcame the world. The very world that was his captor. And yet he overcame. Now, pay attention here to verse 21. The way this prologue closes. It says in verse 21, again, what seems to be just an innocent historical note, but I think it's significant in light of God's plan. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. King Cyrus. Now, we haven't read this far in the book of Daniel, but if you already know your history, you'll know that King Cyrus wasn't a part of the Babylonian Empire, was he? He was a part of the Medo-Persian Empire. What's going on here? You see, what has happened is that this kingdom that in the beginning of chapter 1 seemed so all-powerful, now it's no longer even in existence. Daniel had just outlasted the very ones who took him captive and tried to pressure him into this is the way life is. He just outlived them all. Ask yourself, though, what would have happened if Daniel had put his trust in that kingdom that seemed so all-powerful when he was a young man? I mean, this is the world-dominant power, and they've taken me captive. I guess I'll have to go along with it. What would have happened to Daniel if he had just gone that way? I mean, it seemed perfectly logical, perfectly reasonable. What other way was there for a young man to make it in life? But he didn't do that, did he? He didn't put his trust there. He didn't put his dependence there. He kept it in the Lord. And thus, the Lord gave him the victory. Pardon me. I think Daniel, if he had put his trust there, would have been wiped off the face of the map, just like the kingdom that he had served. But he served the Lord, whose dominion endures forever. And that showed itself in Daniel's endurance. Folks, today, if you pray, as I challenged us last week, your kingdom come. What does that mean? It means, like Daniel, that it's committing you to live as a citizen of heaven in total dependence upon the Lord. You realize your citizenship is not here. You are not first and foremost Americans or anything else that happens to come along in world history. You are God's people. That's your identity. That's your hope. And so you depend upon him entirely. You look to him for your daily bread. You don't look to any economic system. Your loves are not all wrapped up in Wall Street or the gross domestic product or how our economy is going to do next year because my career depends upon it, right? No, that's really not the way we live as believers. Our dependence is upon the Lord who gives us our daily bread. And that leads to a total consecration to him, a complete giving of ourselves to him that we see exemplified by Daniel and his friends here in this chapter. We purpose in our hearts then not to defile ourselves. And that defilement again is all about our relationship to God, about remaining pure before him, about being something that is pleasing to him. And when you have that kind of an attitude, then, and only then, will you have the wisdom that overcomes the world. That's how you gain wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, right? And that's what Daniel had. You see, the Lord is working out his kingdom plan, and your life is a part of that, even down to the smallest details of it, even down to the food you eat and what you drink. It's all part of God's kingdom plan. So, let me urge you today, don't let the world system tell you how you have to live. Don't let it fool you into thinking, this is reality and I have to go along with it. It's just the way things are. Don't ever let that be your driving force. You men who are in business, in the business world, don't let that be your drive. It's just the way things work today. No, it isn't just the way things work. We serve the Lord, no idols. And so we always do things to the best of our endeavor according to His plan and program. And if that means from the worldly perspective that we're not as successful as someone else, okay, that's the way it is. But God gives us our daily bread. We want to please Him. We'll never see through the world's charade if we're depending on it, if we're somehow beholden to it. We'll never be prepared for the times of persecution, which Daniel would later face and his friends would later face, if we haven't already made this critical distance between ourselves and any society in which we live right now. If we don't see ourselves as pilgrims, citizens of heaven, we need that kind of wisdom today. The Lord is working out His kingdom plan. And your life is a part of that. Resolve like Daniel. Follow Christ, and God will grant you the wisdom that overcomes the world.